From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Ocean Howell is history professor and urban historian at the University of Oregon. Thank you so much for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
So happy to be here. Thanks, Barbara.
Let's just start with how you discovered urban history and your life's work.
So I have a real non-traditional route to the discipline. I was a professional skateboarder when I was younger. That was my first real job. I was a pro for Tony Hawk's company called Birdhouse. And I was a street skater primarily, meaning, you know, just feral out in the city rather than in skate parks or purpose-built ramps for the most part. And I was always really kind of just fascinated by the spaces of the city. You know, as I sometimes say, there's skateboarders love landscape architecture more than anyone other than, you know, perhaps landscape architects. And you really sort of study the spaces and you start to wonder after spending so much time in them, you know, why they're designed the way they are. And I also became really interested in public space itself in the kind of broader sense, in the more social sense, you know, just kind of the little micro negotiations of power that happen in public space. Who are spaces designed for? Who is designed against? You know, when we talk about the public, we're never talking about everyone. There's always someone who's implicitly excluded in that category. And that became clear to me. I didn't have the language to explain that when I was a, you know, 19-year-old pro skater, but I understood it. So that was always really fascinating to me. I felt a little unfulfilled as being just a professional skateboarder, so I decided I wanted to go to college, which was not an obvious thing for me to do from given my background. But I was really intrigued by UC Santa Cruz, so I went to do my undergrad there. I studied modern lit, actually, and I wrote my senior thesis on the language philosophies of Heidegger and Derrida. So we're still a ways from urban history, but I really liked philosophy and more kind of theoretical work, but I started to feel like I was floating in space a little bit. And then when I was living in, so afterwards I just went and got a job in a publishing house in San Francisco. Our house was in, we got a notification from the city that we were in a redevelopment survey area. And I didn't know what that was. When I looked it up, I was introduced to the big and often very ugly history of urban renewal in this country. And that fascinated me. So I started doing research on the history. And then I started thinking about that history and my experience of cities. And I realized, for one thing, that many of the best street skating spots are actually old urban renewal areas because they cleared out the old 19th century walking city and created a much more kind of modernist and kind of open, smooth kind of city, a much more skatable city from my perspective. So I was just very interested in why the city was remade in that way. And with kind of my theoretical background, that kind of helped me you know, have a little bit of, you know, some of the intellectual tools to kind of pick this stuff apart. So that's how I got into it. And then I just went from there, and I've been progressively going further and further back into the history of the American city. You know, I started out, of course, with just exclusively post-war, but I've been doing a lot of work on the progressive era and even, you know, the founding of American cities. So,
You've kind of had your observations about who, in fact, cities are designed for, or who, mm-hmm. who they're redeveloping it for, do you find that there's some kind of movement towards, hey, we have a skater guy here, let's have him talk about it, or some other kind of do you think some urban planners are interested enough in creative ways of looking at it that is changing?
100%, yeah, which is really gratifying to see. Honestly, I never thought I'd see it. Yeah, that is happening. I mean, cities now, I mean, most people are probably aware when you walk through a city and you see those little knobs on a knobs or brackets on a bench. Those are to keep people from skateboarding. Sometimes they're doing dual duty to keep people from sleeping on them also. And, you know, you get chased out of spots. There's no skateboarding signs everywhere. That was the environment that I was skateboarding the time when anyone even thought to design against it explicitly, but I witnessed that whole that entire thing develop, the whole anti-skate architecture. But in the last handful of years, American cities have really started to come around. I mean, it starts in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, where they start saying, okay, look, there are a lot of people doing this. This is a real constituency of you know, mostly young people. And so they started building skate parks, but that was, and which is wonderful. I'm a big advocate for them, but it was also a way to kind of corral people into certain spaces and keep them out of other parts of the city. Actually, the real movement happened first in European cities, which was really fascinating to see. And I had written some stuff. The first kind of critical things I wrote were about skateboarding. And I've since, you know, branched out into a lot of other stuff. But a lot of cities in Europe actually got in touch with me, and they invited me out to talk to them. So Bordeaux, France, and Malmo in Sweden, London. These are all places, particularly Malmo and Bordeaux. London's still wrestling with it a little bit. But Malmo and Bordeaux have really started to integrate skateboarding into their urban design. There is, in fact, Malmo has a person named Gustav Eden, who is, I forget exactly what his title is, but basically he's like I think he might even be like kind of an at-large city councilor, like an interest group city councilor rather than a you know, territorially defined. That might not be exactly his position, but basically his job is to work with the city. And whenever there's a new development happening, they come to him and ask him if it's sensible to integrate skateboarding into it. And he finds that there's skateboarding isn't just something that, you know, does damage and gets in the way of pedestrians. It also activates spaces and creates social life in places. So the European city started doing that. You know, they've been doing this for, you know, 15, 20 years. More recently, a lot of American cities, I mean, San Francisco recently redesigned UN Plaza so as to attract skateboarders, which is fascinating, very smart. It made the space much safer, much more user-friendly. I mean, I hasten to add that, you know, a lot of times when city planners are looking to integrate skateboarders, it's because they're looking to push out people who are kind of on lower rungs of the social ladder. So, you know, unhoused people, people with, it's a way that planners look to get rid of open air drug markets. You know, I don't want to present it as a purely good thing that doesn't have social complications to it. It is complicated, but I still think in general, it's kind of a good movement that they're starting to integrate people into the spaces.
Well, there's also has been a perception, certainly of older people, well, skateboarders. Why are you bringing that society in?
Yeah.
But in fact, yeah, it's not what you think.
Yeah.
Skateboarders are not what you think.
Some of them are, and some of them aren't. Yeah,
I
mean, that's right. The thing. Yeah, I mean, the last time I looked at the sports marketing data was a very long time ago, but I think I looked at it in 2005 or something. But even back then, they estimated there were 12 million skateboarders in the United States. So whenever you get a group of people that large, you're going to have a huge range of people. And so I would just hope that, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to defend the behavior of every single skateboarder everywhere, but, you know, I would also... I mean, there's a couple things to note. For one thing, a lot of those folks are, you know, people like me. I know a lot of, I'm the only professor that I know of. Well, I know of, excuse me, a retired professional who's a professor. I know a lot of professors who are very good skateboarders. Also artists, you know, entrepreneurs, company owners, planners. You know, you get a whole range of kind of white collar America among skateboarders. That's who they're going to grow into. And, you know, for a lot of people, and I would actually include myself in this category. Like I said, my background is not, I'm a first gen college student. And, you know, I grew up around some fairly rough stuff and, you know, a life of drug addiction and, you know, serious troubles was not, you know, that was definitely on the menu for me, as it is for a lot of other folks. So there's a lot of people also for whom skateboarding is a real positive thing in their lives. You know, if they're out there skating, you can't be, you know, wasted, drunk, or on heroin skateboarding. It doesn't work. So for a lot of folks, it's actually an escape from those things and a very healthy aspect of their life. And I would just hope that people would kind of look at them, you know, understand it's a very varied group of people, and also that, you know, for a lot of those folks, skateboarding is actually a very positive thing and is much more likely to keep them on a healthy healthy path than some of the other activities that are available to them, you know. So
as you look at spaces, we can use the example of San Francisco, but wherever, as you look at spaces and conversations with urban planners, and here's a place that exists, and it existed before, and mm-hmm. it's going to exist into the future, how does that kind of movement through history inform, or how maybe do you believe it should inform, new spaces there, if that makes sense?
You mean
if you have a park that's been, or a street corner that's been a certain way, and it was a certain way 100 years ago and it's now, and people are going, oh, we're going to redesign it, or we're going to rethink it. Yeah. How does that historical context move into that conversation?
I think it should always be present. You know, it's a thing we always need to consider. What was the space? How was it used? You know, if you're in, you know, the formal preservation discipline, you want to think very much about, you know, whether or not there's architectural significance there, or and that can mean, you know, to landscape architecture and planning also. It should always be considered, but I would say that it should not always be the decisive factor, and there are plenty of examples that people have been writing about recently, you know, that demonstrate, you know, very clearly, to my mind, that a lot of the you know, historic preservation has kind of been instrumentalized in service of gentrification, and is actually does damage to the production of much needed housing, among other things. So, I mean, you know, within historic preservation districts, for example, if you're a houser. Housers don't love preservation districts, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but what it often does is you know, radically limits what people can do with their properties, and that includes, you know, creating additional housing on that property, and we really need it. And there's a lot of, you know, California has really been wrestling with this too. It's part of you know, I guess they're folded into kind of environmental impact reviews, but they certainly might have a separate review for any plan that's submitted to a city needs to go through an historic preservation review. And sometimes that's just instrumentalized in ways that are disingenuous and that are meant to prevent people just don't want development. It's a great tool in the toolbox of NIMBYs. Now, that said, I have heard discussions where people just go too far the opposite direction, that, you know, we should just kind of eliminate these considerations altogether. I think that's a mistake, too. There needs to be. I think it always needs to be considered, but shouldn't be the decisive factor.
You have a lot of projects that are going on, but one of that you had mentioned in a previous conversation has to do with this interactive map, and having to do with the history of space and the new space, and I'd like you to talk about that.
Right, thank you so much. So the project I'm working on now, which is close to done, not quite, but close, is called Imagined San Francisco. Past tense, Imagined San Francisco. If you'd like to check it out, it's at imaginedsanfrancisco.org. So this is a project I developed, about 10 years ago now, or almost 10 years ago now, started developing it at Stanford at their digital humanities lab. What I've done is I've taken what I'm going to claim is every significant map in the history of San Francisco and digitized it, georeferenced it, given the points on the map, actual latitude, longitude points, and collected them all on this website. So you can turn on and off any map that you like and fade them in and out over each other. And what this allows you to do is to see what the city used to look like. And also I make a special point of including unrealized urban plans so that you can see not only what the city would have did look like, but what it would have looked like had certain plans been enacted. And you can get down to really fine grain, down to the block level, and see, you know, lot by lot, you know, building by building, how the city would have been had these other plans been enacted. Not each map, but many of the maps are accompanied by what I call pin layers. So these are kind of, they're below the maps, and if you turn them on, what you see is a bunch of red points show up on the screen, and they'll have arrows. Now, what that means is if you're at that point and looking in that direction, here's what you would have seen. So there'll be a pop-up, which is either, you know, usually an historic photograph or an architectural rendering. And the ones that I really like are the renderings of what the city would have looked like. You know, unrealized urban plans are particularly fascinating. So if you're standing right here and looking out, looking north to Marin, you would have seen three different bridges spanning the Golden Gateway there, and connecting to Marin. The bridge plans are particularly fun. Each one of those of the maps is accompanied by a brief essay. Some of them are a little longer, where I'm giving, you know, just explaining what the map is, and sometimes I'm making real kind of historical arguments about, you know, how we should read these maps. There's another section which I call narratives, which is a more kind of, so that's that section is under just, it's called maps and plans. And that I think of as kind of, you know, it's both a research tool and it's a public history resource. You know, it's those maps are all out there and anyone can go find them, but it's really hard if you're just a person with a job. You know, you're not going to go digging stuff up from archives. It's even hard to find them in some of the digital archives. But this makes all of this stuff very accessible to the public in ways that they can easily interact with. And you can, you know, maybe you just want to know what your house would have been, or you're a tourist and are curious what you know, how the city grew. But it's particularly interesting if you look at the original maps to see, like, the coastline, for example. You can see that the coastline was very jagged before. It's all perfectly, the eastern coastline of San Francisco is all perfectly straight line now. That is not nature's doing. That's ours. We filled it. You can see the history of all that fill. All that stuff is kind of interesting just to understand. It's also a good resource for researchers. So I have the Homeowners Loan Corporation maps in there. The original redlining maps. So just as one example, you can get in there and see, you know, what areas were redlined, what areas were what we call green lined, considered, you know, safe investments, you know, and compare that to freeway plans, to urban renewal projects, that sort of thing. So and then as I started to say, I have another section. It's called narratives, which gives a more kind of curated trip through the project. So these are scholarly essays, and what happens is the essay is on the left-hand side, and as you scroll down, the visualization on the right will kind of change automatically. So it will drawing your attention to the analysis that I'm describing in the essay itself. So the visualization will kind of evolve to illustrate the points that I'm making. That part is still it works great, but I'm still just a little ways along with the narratives. That's the least developed part. So I hope people will go there. Please know that it is beta. It is a draft form, but there's enough there to see the project. What I'm starting to do now also is build a new version of this. I'm building a new one for Portland. I'm doing that now. That one, I don't want to share the URL for that one yet because it's very, very beta. I'm also doing it using a different platform. The original one, I don't want to get too much into the technical details, but it's kind of, it's complicated to do and requires access to, you know, Stanford's web map server. Any web map server would work, I suppose, but it's hard to get access to them. So you need a web map server. You also need a good coder because it's based on WordPress, which is very intuitive to use, but it's a little complicated on the back end. Is the simplest way to say it. But what I'm developing now, and I'm testing it with the Portland site, is an open source software that bypasses the need for web map servers. And also requires no coding experience. And so the back-end processes are a lot more intuitive. So the point of doing this is so that other people can use it. I really believe in the platform. I'm calling it Mapping History right now. And my big hope is that, everyone will use this. I mean, not only other scholars, high school teachers, and local historical societies. You know, I think it could have a lot of use for planning departments. You know, at least for, you know, they have GIS, so they don't need it for their own analysis, but as a means of communicating with the public, I think it's has a lot of potential. So I'm really excited by that, and that I think will be the, you know, in 10 years' time, the real measure of the success of the thing is how many other people are using the platform. So,
in terms of going back to urban planning, mm-hmm. and how urban planning works, and kind of your experience with it, to someone like me who knows, you know, I know what urban planning is and I've met some urban planners. I know nothing really about it. It seems a little staid, but, you know, it might be super interesting. I'm sure it is. What do you think is working in terms of innovation? Do you think things are changing? Do you think people are going, oh, yeah, maybe we should actually look at this? Do you think, how is that evolving?
In the present, yeah. I think there are some really promising trends. I mean, the skateboarding thing, as I've said, skateboarding is only one example of ways in which I think, planners are starting to think, be a little more broad-minded about who's the public, you know, and I think that's very promising on the level of kind of, you know, individual public spaces. In terms of, you know, broader trends. I mean, I'm talking a little bit outside of school. I'm an historian, but I'm very happy
right.
to.
Exactly. I know just, you are, and I'm not. I don't need to delve into it deeply, but I mean, from the perspective of someone who's kind of looked at cities and looked at these historical.
Yeah,
maps.
I definitely have an informed perspective, but I just want to caveat that I'm not the expert here. But so some of the trends I see, some of them are a little troublesome. I mean, as we all know, there's a serious housing crisis. You know, pretty much in cities all over the West Coast, and in major cities all over the country. The bad news is that we're not catching up quickly enough. That's pretty clear in most places. Anyway, I'm sure there's exceptions to that. The good news, though, is that it is leading the profession to rethink some of their old practices. For example, as we were talking about before, environmental reviews. A lot of those have really become onerous, and the purpose of them is to is to ensure that they're not, you know, creating unintended consequences and everything. But the thing is, when you start piling on so many of these types of reviews, it starts to have another unintended consequence, which is to halt everything, to halt the development of much needed housing. So I think the profession is realizing that and starting to look at ways of streamlining things. I know here in Oregon, they are, there is basically a lot of what you would call deregulation. You know, they are kind of getting some of the old rules off the books in order to, you know, try to incentivize the construction of new housing, obviously, especially affordable housing. But all housing is good. You know, if you upper income housing means that there's less pressure on housing stock kind of down the scale, and that becomes available to other folks. So the houser's perspective is that what we need we need affordable housing, but what we just need is housing of all descriptions. You know, you might exclude, absurd mega mansions from that. But for the most part, all housing is good housing. That's a good trend. There are some things I would say that are, we talked a little bit about the history of urban renewal. We've focused on the ways in which that program really became a massive discriminatory land grab. You know, that's what the historiography really describes. But I mean, among those of us in the profession, the historians, that is to say, there's also a reevaluation of that history. You know, we're in no danger of forgetting about, you know, a lot of these massive clearances. You know, classic ones being, you know, Chavez Ravine in L.A. for Dodgers Stadium, which removed a Latinx neighborhood, you know, poor working neighborhood. And, you know, the Western Addition in San Francisco, which just, you know, clear cut, you know, a huge portion of the city and, you know, not surprisingly, an African-American portion of the city. And, kind of dispersed these folks all over and didn't even track where they went. And it destroyed more housing than it created. You know, so there's a lot of very well-documented abuses of that program. There are also examples of the program, even early examples, that worked as they were intended to. Bringing this back to the present, I think we might have overlearned some of those lessons a little bit and to the point where there's a suspicion of any state power. You know, if the state is coming in and says that they want to redevelop an area, well, they just immediately picture the bulldozers idling. And they should be wary of that. Communities should definitely be concerned about that. But there are plenty of examples where the state has used some of these tools, the tools of eminent domain, funding for urban renewal. They have, you know, very particular kind of funding strategies and ways of getting money into places where that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get it, that are very promising and would really help cities. So I think people are starting to realize that, but there is a obviously there people are nervous for obvious and good reasons. But I think maybe some of the cities ought to be willing to consider the possibility that some of these tools are actually very useful, and as long as there's community control of them, that they can really help in a lot of ways. So.
How about your students? Who are your students, and what are kind of the questions they're raising, or why are they gravitated to your particular part of history?
Primarily Oregonians. It was Oregon, the UO is kind of funny. It's kind of countercyclical with economic crises. When there's an economic crisis, a flood of Californians come up here because it's a good education. You know, it's comparable to UC's, but it's more affordable. So we'll have phases where there's a good mix of Californians in there. I don't want to guess at figures, but I would say roughly, you know, 30% thereabouts. Someone will tell me I'm wrong about that, but.
oh well.
A lot. Let's just say that, like a lot of Californians, and then when that recedes, it's overwhelmingly Oregonians. We do have a good mix of, folks from lower income backgrounds too. I've been very surprised and pleased to see how many first gen kids I have. As a first gen kid myself, I'm always very happy to have those students. And they are interested. I think part of the reason they're interested in my courses is because they're about here. You know, they're about, I'm doing research on Portland, on, San Francisco, on the kind of urbanized West Coast overwhelmingly. But my big urban history class, I start in, ancient Europe just to show the roots. But then I talk about American cities, so a lot of times history seems like something it's far off in time, but also geographically far off. I really encourage people to look around them. It's all around us. If you walk out your door and look at the buildings surrounding you, you're looking at history, and you just have to learn how to read those. The built environment itself is a terrific source. So I do an exercise with my students where I take them out with old fire insurance maps and historic photographs, and I make them triangulate between the three. Look at the building itself, look at this old map, and then look at this old photograph. And by putting all these things together, you can kind of you can tell a very interesting history. Cities are, whenever you see a building, that's an expression of power somehow or other. Someone had the resources to make that what they wanted it to be. Someone else probably had a different idea for what that could be, who won and who lost and why. I sometimes say that we're, the fish who don't see the water we swim in, right? The city around us was something that is the product of millions of little decisions that were made and power relations and, social histories, economic histories, certainly, institutional and governmental histories. You can tell all kinds of histories with just the stuff that's all around us in our everyday life. So I know that at least some of my students are attracted to that idea, to understand that it's all around them. When they walk down the street, they can, there are fascinating and worthy histories to tell. So.
What inspires you, Ocean, to keep doing this work and teach these classes and walk around and make your maps?
For the particular project I'm working on now, the mapping history project, I'm really inspired by partly by the new technologies. Honestly, they have tremendous capacity to speak to a broader audience. It's no secret that kind of academic writing can be a little impenetrable. Unfortunately, those are our incentives. If you're in the profession, I'll say it, discouraged to write to a broad public. You're writing to other experts. That's just the way that the profession is structured. But with these new technologies, I think there's really an opportunity to do both. I very much like the idea of making this work accessible to people, to instill in them to inspire them to think about the city in the ways I was just describing, to understand that there's fascinating histories all around us. So I'm inspired by the capacity to do both of those things at the same time, to speak to the public while also speaking to fellow experts in my subfield. I don't mean to demean that. I think that's very important, and it's very important that those conversations happen, the kind of the more rigorous academic conversations that, because the facts are sometimes very difficult to tease out, and you do want to have really in-depth kind of arguments and wrestle with one another about how we should interpret these things. We want to have, you know, it's just for the record, even if it's only going to be read by you know, the small handful of experts in a subfield. That's what's going to happen now. We don't know how this information might be useful to people in the future, but it's important just for the sake of knowledge and truth to have the story straight. So I don't mean to, I still am very much committed to the kind of traditional academic discipline, but I'm inspired by the possibility of broadening that out too.
Anything you want to add here? Any closing thoughts? Any kind of topic we've skipped over that you're like, no, I really need to go there?
No, I don't think so. No, it's been really fun to chat, and thanks so much for inviting me in. I am eventually going to do one of those websites I was describing to you on Eugene, and I would just ask people to keep an eye out for that. Probably a couple years off, but it's coming one of these days.
We'll look for it.
Okay.
Thank you, Professor Ocean Howell, for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
Thanks so much, Barbara. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.